You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email, sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. Steve Williams was appointed Executive Director of the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission and the Charlottesville Albemarle Metropolitan Planning Organization in Charlottesville in May 2009. Under his leadership, the Charlottesville Albemarle County MPO has focused on planning performance-based measurement, land use transportation coordination, expansion of the region's transit system, and bike and pedestrian transportation. Mr. Williams spoke at the October 13, 2010 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member Tom Boyd.
Today, I'm very fortunate to be your moderator and to have the privilege of introducing our speaker, Mr. Steve Williams, who will be speaking on the public involvement in transportation planning. Steve was appointed Executive Director of the Thomas Jefferson Planning District and the Charlottesville Albemarle Metropolitan Planning Organization, MPO, in Charlottesville in May of 2009. Under his leadership, the Charlottesville Albemarle MPO, has been focusing on planning based on performance measurement, land use transportation coordination, expansion of the region's transit systems, and bike and pedestrian transportation. Prior to his move to Charlottesville, Steve was executive director of the Nashua Regional Planning Commission and MPO between January 2004 and May 2009. During his time at NRPC, he focused his attention on issues related to regional infrastructure, transportation systems, and coordination of land use and transportation. Prior to coming to NRPC, he spent 10 years at the Association of Monterey Bay Area Governments, the MPO, for the three-county Monterey, Salinas, Santa Cruz, California metropolitan area, and Monterey, California. He also spent 7 years at the East Central Intergovernmental Association, the MPO for the three-state MPO in Dubuque, Iowa. Steve received his Master of City and Regional Planning in 1985 from California Polytechnic State University at San Luis Obispo and a Bachelor of Science from Montana State University in 1983. Steve is married his wife Jennifer for 26 years and has two teenage children, Joel and Rachel, and I understand a dog, Shasta. In his spare time, Steve enjoys recreational biking, Civil War history, and reading. It's a great pleasure to welcome Steve here today. And Mr. Mac Lafferty, who is no stranger to our program.
Thank you. I don't want to take away from what Steve says. I am on the vice chair of the chart committee, and as you can see, chart is the citizens committee on the transportation for the local area. It is an advisory committee. I represent the Alamo County Planning Commission right now. We decided about a year or so ago that the transportation issues were so complex that we wanted to put together some kind of presentation and bring it to the public. And we want to get your participation in the presentation this afternoon to get feedback. Transportation is a very complicated issue, as you are well aware of, and the recent opening of part of the Meadow Creek Parkway. And we want people to try to understand the process and the length of time that it takes to get from an idea to where you can actually travel on it on the road or on a bike path. I welcome you here today. I'm glad to see all these eager faces, and I hope you'll have lots of questions. If any of you, and Kathy has already approached me, if any of you are interested in coming on CHART, which is the Citizen Advisory Committee, there's currently some openings. You can apply, and we look forward to it. Everyone is welcome to come to our meetings. They are held every other month, and there's public notice about that. Again, thank you. I appreciate you being here. Steve?
Thank you. Okay. Well, it's great to be here this afternoon. I am Steve Williams, and I appreciate Mac and his service on the CHART committee. It's a great group of folks who are really engaged on transportation issues. We actually have a couple of former CHART members in the back, Jerry Diley and John Faltz. We have a current CHART member right over here on the other side, Bobby Burke. You want to wave your hand, Bobby? There you go. Bobby Burke is one of our current members, and then actually one of TJPDC's transportation planners, Sarah Eisler, is with us today back in the back corner, and I really appreciate Sarah because she tells me where to go and who to talk to, and keeps our whole process, really keeps the whole circus running. So as Mac mentioned, what I'd like to talk to you about today is the transportation planning process here for the Charlottesville region, and specifically about, you know, your concerns about the transportation system that we have here in the Charlottesville Albemarle region, as well as some issues related to how we're going to fund the transportation system going forward. And so hopefully I am capable of using this thing, so we'll see. It did work. Now, when we were being introduced by Tom, he talked about the fact that I am the executive director of what's called the Metropolitan Planning Organization. Have any of you heard of a Metropolitan Planning Organization before you came into this room this afternoon? Yeah, well, actually, I'm surprised. That's more than I expected. The Metropolitan Planning Organization is the federally mandated planning organization for transportation planning. Basically, if you have an urban area over 50,000 people, and you are going to use federal funds for transportation improvements, you are required to have a metropolitan planning organization. I'm also the executive director of Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission. Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission is the regional planning agency for what we call Planning District 10, or the Central Virginia region. That includes, actually, if you look at that map, you can see five counties on there: Albemarle, Fluvanna, Greene, Louisa, and Nelson. And you also see the city of Charlottesville. And those are our six member governments. The lighter shaded area that includes Charlottesville, as well as some of the surrounding area of Albemarle County, is the area that we call the Metropolitan Planning Organization. And so the MPO only covers the city of Charlottesville and the most urbanized area of the surrounding Albemarle County. What do we do? There are actually about three broad things that we do. I guess I'm going to point to the bottom one first. That might be confusing for you, but we implement what they call the 3C process. The Federal Highway Administration and the federal government, going back to the early 60s, has required that there be what they call a 3C process for transportation planning in each metropolitan area. The three C's are continuing, meaning ongoing, comprehensive, meaning we've got to cover everything, and cooperative. And cooperative, as you know, is a sometime thing. But so the purpose is that all the agencies involved in transportation planning are stakeholders in the process. So we coordinate all of those, the actions of all those stakeholders. We work with all of them. In this region, those stakeholders are the city of Charlottesville, Albemarle County, Virginia Department of Transportation, Virginia Department of Rail and Public Transportation, Charlottesville Area Transit, University of Virginia, the JAUNT, And our chart committee is also represented on our MPO policy board by MAC. Our 3C process also includes members of the public. And so one of the things that we're trying to do here over the course of the next few years is reach out to lots of different groups of members of the public, just like yourselves, and find out what folks think about transportation. Sir, you had a question? That is the Federal Highway Administration. They are the organization within USDOT that deals with roads and highways. A couple of other things our MPO does is we coordinate the various transportation agencies, and we also publish or develop and adopt both long-range and short-range transportation plans. We really have two main documents that we focus our attention on. We have what's called the Long-Range Transportation Plan, which for this region is called UNJAM. And the purpose of that document is to identify the transportation needs in the region over the course of the next 20-year time frame and to identify the ways that we're going to be able to meet those needs in that same time period. And then we also have what's a short-term document called our Transportation Improvement Program. And I think the easiest way to think of that document is to think of it as our budget for the next 5-year period. It identifies everything we intend to spend money on within the next 5 years in terms of transportation improvements. Both of these documents are required to be what we call fiscally constrained, meaning we're not allowed to plan to spend more money than we can reasonably expect to have available. And so a big issue that we've had over the last few years is that we've had a smaller and smaller pot of money that we can reasonably expect to have available, and that's something that we'll talk about here later in the presentation. So that's really what the MPO does. Our CHART Citizens Advisory Committee, Max already told you a little bit about it. Basically, this is sort of the organization of our MPO. At the top, you see a box that's labeled, kind of a russet-colored box labeled MPO Policy Board. Those are the elected officials that ultimately make the decisions about where the money is going to get spent on transportation improvements in the region. And that board, the voting members of that board are two city council members from Charlottesville, two members of the Board of Supervisors from Albemarle County, and then the district administrator for this district from Virginia Department of Transportation. We also have on the left-hand side of the slide a technical committee, which is made up of technical staff members from all the member agencies in the MPO, the city, the county, VDOT, the transit systems, the university. And then on the other side, we have our chart committee. And our chart committee's responsibility is to take the lead on outreach to the community, to members of the public, to make sure that they have a voice in our transportation process. And so this presentation that we're doing with you today is actually a result of about, 9 months, I think, of effort on the part of our chart committee. And then finally, of course, everybody interacts with the public, and they're shown in the box, the blue box at the bottom. And then in the center, you can see our MPO staff, and I guess the way I look at that diagram is our MPO staff is getting pulled in four different directions at once. Let's see here. So public participation initiative, you're probably all familiar with sort of the traditional way of doing public participation. You come up, you figure out what an issue is, a project that you have to do, you study it, you come up with a variety of alternatives that you do very thorough study of, and then you put that all together and you go out to a public hearing and hundreds of people show up and tell you that you're idiots. That model of public participation frankly doesn't really serve anybody's needs very well. I mean, I, to tell you the truth, don't like going to meetings and being told I'm an idiot. Often true, but I still don't like to hear it. And then on the other side, it really doesn't give the members of the public an opportunity to have a say at the front end about what we really need or what they're really concerned about. And so what we're trying to do with the help of the Chart Committee is to put out sort of a new initiative on public participation where we actually go out to the public in groups like this seeking public comment and input before we begin drafting the plan so that we can get a better idea of what, you know, citizens like yourselves who are not on any elected board or body think are the important issues in the region and what you think are the approaches we should be using to deal with those issues. So our goal is to have more proactive input rather than reactive or confrontational type of input. So what is transportation planning? That may seem obvious to you, but I spend a lot of time wondering about that. Transportation planning provides information, tools, public involvement needed to improve transportation system performance, and that's really what this is all about, is how well our transportation system works, how well it performs, because it is such an integral part of our lives. We need our transportation system to make our economy work. We need it to, you know, get to our workplaces, to the doctor, to, you know, go shopping. Every day, all of us interact with our transportation system in many different ways. But transportation planning is also a continuous process that requires us to continually be monitoring the transportation system's performance and its condition and how well it's meeting our needs. This is a slide that shows kind of the traditional way that transportation planning has taken place in this country over, say, the last 50 or 60 year time frame since maybe the end of World War II. If I could just kind of start in the upper left here, we start out with some sort of land use change taking place. We get a subdivision that's built in an area that was formerly forest or fields. We get some new office buildings being built in an area that were some sort of lower density development. Either way, that land use change leads to increased traffic generation, which you can see in the third slide on the top row there. And when you get increased traffic generation, eventually you get increased traffic conflict because there are always going to be places where there are more cars and trucks trying to go through the system than the system is really capable of processing. So when we get that conflict, we get increased congestion, and we certainly, I'm sure, all know what congestion looks like. Then, inevitably, over a very long period of time, because the transportation process takes a long time, we get some roadway improvements that are ultimately built. Those roadway improvements down here in the lower left lead for a short period of time to decreased congestion. But one of the things that happens when we build new roadway segments is that the segments of land that are along that new roadway increase in value because now it's easier to get to them. And so we've all seen what happens when you build that additional roadway capacity, the land value increases, and ultimately the landowners and developers see that increase in value and say, okay, now is a good time to cash out my value by developing something on the property. That leads us back to the beginning of the cycle, and we go around and around. And the end result of that is that because that's the way the cycle's been working, we're never able to build enough transportation capacity to meet the needs of our society. When we build transportation capacity, we are, in effect, increasing the demand. And so what we've been trying to do here in the Charlottesville area, and this is not just TJPDC and the MPO, but also the City of Charlottesville and Virginia Department of Transportation and Albemarle County, we're trying to find a way to balance the supply of transportation against the demand, and we're trying to keep them both in balance. Now, if you've driven on Highway 29 recently, you probably think we're not doing a very good job of that, but we actually, I think, here in this region, have learned a hard lesson from Highway 29 about why this doesn't work. And so the next slide that I'm going to show here kind of shows the way we hope the cycle is going to work in the future. The first step, again, of course, is land use change. Land uses are going to continue to change and develop. They're going to lead to increased trip generation. But where we're hoping to go is that instead of simply leading to increased trip generation, that we can start to develop what we call sustainable land use policies that will allow us to basically allow our transportation needs to be met without necessarily generating a need for more cars on the road. And so one of the ways that we hope that that will take place is through encouraging compact development. Another thing that we hope will happen is increased use of alternative modes, and those are shown kind of in the lower center and lower right-hand corner. The result of that, we hope, is that we can maintain a stable traffic flow instead of experiencing the conflict and congestion that we've all had here recently. And then when increased land value takes place, that we can continue to see compact development, increased use of alternative modes, and so as a result, continue to experience stable traffic flow and not need to build a lot of new transportation facilities in the future the way we've had to do because of the older style of land development and transportation improvement here in Central Virginia. So that's kind of your primer on how land use and transportation interact, and that is, I think, a pretty important issue for you to understand, because that is one of the issues that we are struggling to get a handle on, not only here in Central Virginia, but also really throughout the rest of the country. I think the transportation profession in general has recognized that there isn't any place in this country where we can build as much transportation capacity as we need. And so if you think of transportation, the transportation system as the supply and land use as the demand, we've come to recognize that since we can't provide infinite supply, that we've got to control the demand. And that's what that land use strategy is about. Just kind of segueing here, our current transportation network that we're focused on at the MPO, you know about the primary roads, Interstate 64, US 29, US 250, Route 20, Route 22, Route 53. We also have the transit system, and you're probably familiar with the transit system. You've got Charlottesville Area Transit. Sarah has obviously not made a change in this slide since the name changed a couple of months ago. We have Jaunt that provides on-demand service actually throughout six counties here in the region. We have the University Transit System, which provides a huge number of transit rides for university staff, faculty, and students. We even have Amtrak here. And you just saw the other day in the newspaper the one-year anniversary of the start of the new Amtrak service. We have some commuter options here in the region. We actually operate the rideshare system for the region out of our office. You've probably seen the signs on as you're driving on the highway about commuter options, call this 800 number. Well, that rings in our office, and hopefully somebody picks that up. We also work with Virginia Department of Transportation and Department of Rail and Public Transportation on the park and ride lots. We have a lot of bike and pedestrian facilities here in the Charlottesville-Albemarle area. The city maintains 255 miles of sidewalk and 14 miles of on-street bike lanes. And then, of course, we have the airport. One thing that most people don't realize is that 28% of the automobile trips that are made in this country are 1 mile or less in length. 28%. And 40% of the auto trips that are made in this country are 2 miles or less in length. And so one of the things that we've recognized, and transportation professionals all over the country have recognized, is that those little short trips are putting a lot of cars on the road that don't necessarily need to be there. If we had better pedestrian facilities, better bike facilities, we could take those trips off the road and let the roads be used for the longer trips that aren't really practical on foot or by bike. And so we think that investment in new pedestrian facilities and new biking facilities is a very efficient way to meet our transportation needs, not only in this region, but also nationwide. Yeah, let's see here. Okay, I thought I'd just been there. Oh, I'm holding the remote upside down. That's really embarrassing, you know. Okay, transportation plans. I kind of went through these a few minutes ago. The Transportation Improvement Program, which is our budget, if you will, the long-range transportation plan. We also work quite closely with the localities, the city and the county, with their long, comprehensive plans, because they really tell us a lot about what they expect to have happen and what kind of transportation systems they're going to need in the future. And then we also develop a lot of targeted transportation plans that focus on improving a specific portion of the transportation system. So, for instance, we worked with Virginia Department of Transportation in Albemarle County on Places 29, which was a plan for both the land use and the transportation system on US 29 from Hydraulic Road all the way up to, basically all the way to the Greene County line. We worked with Albemarle County on the Pantoffs Master Plan. We took the lead on what is called the 29H250 plan that looked at alternative approaches to improving this hideous interchange down here at US 29, US 250, and Hydraulic Road. And we're also in the process of developing a bike and pedestrian master plan. We also took the lead on the plan for the development of the Regional Transit Authority that was going to expand transit service more out into Albemarle County. Here are just kind of some facts about both the region and also about our transportation system. Demographics, in 2007, we had about 69,600 people employed here in the Charlottesville-Albemarle metropolitan area. And by 2035, we expect that number is going to increase to just over 101,000 people employed here. In 2007, we estimated the population here to be just over 117,000. We expect that population to rise to 160,000 people by 2035. So there is definitely more growth coming in this region. One of the things that we do when we're looking at transportation is we try to forecast the use of various transportation systems within the region. So in 2007, we estimated that there were 553,000 daily person trips within the region. That means that all of the people here in the region made an average of 553,000 trips a day. And those are all kinds of trips. Those could be car trips, but they could also be bike trips, walk trips, could even be transit trips, plane trips. But they made 553,000 trips. We're expecting that number to increase by 2035 to about 684,000 trips a day. The breakdown on those is that in 2007, out of those 553,000, 491,000 were made by auto. About just short of 7,000 a day were made using our transit systems, and about almost 55,000 a day were made either by bike or by walking. By 2035, we expect the auto trips to be just short of 600,000 a day, transit trips to be up at about 9,400 a day, and then the bike and walk trips to be just short of 75,000. One of the things that we also look at is what we call the average daily vehicle miles traveled. And what that means is that if we could add up the distance that every vehicle in the region moves over the course of the day together, that would be this figure. So we estimated in 2007 that there, on a daily basis, 4,368,000 miles of vehicle travel in this region, which is pretty impressive for a small region like this one. We're forecasting that that is going to increase to 5,159,000 by 2035. That works out to an average of 8.89 miles per vehicle in 2007 and 8.6 miles per vehicle in 2035. Analysis of those facts and projections, I think I've already given you most of that. Basically, population growth is coming. You know, we probably find that hard to believe right now because of the recession that we've been in for several years and the conditions that prevail right now. But we expect that over the course of time, the rate of growth in the Charlottesville-Albemarle area is going to return to sort of the historical average of about 2% per year. As we get that growth, of course, all modes of transportation are expected to increase. And you saw a slight decrease in the average miles per trip and of about 0.3 miles. What we think is going to happen here is that over the course of coming years, we're going to see increased transit ridership as basically we get more people, denser population, but the same sized area. One of the things that we wanted to do is to give you a timeline for the development of a typical roadway improvement. The reason that we wanted to do this is that most people don't have any concept of how long it takes to develop a transportation project. I tell anybody that will listen that a transportation project is like raising your kids. It takes about 20 years, and you often don't get at the end what you thought you had at the beginning. And I'm sure that there are probably many people in this room who can appreciate that. I know my kids are 19 and 17, and I'm certainly, you know, experiencing that myself. A timeline on a transportation project starts with a project idea. We incorporate that into our long-range transportation plan once we've done quite a bit of study of that idea. The local jurisdictions then adopt it onto their funding priority list. Our MPO policy board, you remember I mentioned the elected officials that make the decisions for the MPO, they adopt that priority list. It then goes to the state body called the Commonwealth Transportation Board, and they adopt a state priority list. At all four of those steps that I just named, there are opportunities for public involvement. Then the hard part comes. It's easy to identify ideas. It's easy to study ideas. Identifying and acquiring the funding is the hardest part of this process. Once we get the funding, though, we can get to construction, and then once the roadway is built, we get to monitoring and the maintenance of the completed facility. And so typically, we see 2 to 3 years of planning on that timeline. We see 2 to 3 years to identify funding. I guess my reaction to that is that's only true if you're very, very lucky. In many cases, it can take you, 10, 15 years to identify the funding for a transportation project. It often takes us 4 to 6 years to do the environmental review for a project, depending on how severe the environmental impacts are. It'll take 2 to 3 years to design the project, actually to draw the drawings that are used by the construction guys to build the thing. It'll take a year or two of right-of-way acquisition, and then finally 2 to 3 years for construction. And so, as I said, 13 to 20 years for a typical project. If it's for some reason a difficult or contentious project, it might take 50 years. I had a project that I was working on at my last job in New Hampshire. That organization that I work for in New Hampshire was formed in 1959, and I had the minutes from the organizational meeting in a file on my desk, and they identified as their number one priority for the region a highway project called Circumferential Highway. And when I was there this decade, I left there last year, we were still working on the Circumferential Highway 50 years later. So that is not at all unusual. So here's the part where we want to learn from you. My lovely assistant, Sarah, is going to hand out some input forms. And our purpose on these input forms is to give you an opportunity to tell us what you think the transportation system needs are here in the region, and what you would like us to focus our attention on, and how you would like us to spend the money. What we're doing, as I mentioned earlier, is we're going to go around to a lot of different groups, make this presentation. We hope to actually make this presentation to 400 or 500 different people here in the region from all walks of life in all different kinds of situations, and try to get a good cross-section of our community telling us what they would like to see us do. And so Sarah's handing out the forms right now, and I think we've even got little golf course pencils if you happen to need a pencil or a writing utensil. And then what I'm going to do is take you through these slides and ask you some questions that I'd like to respond you to respond to on the form. On the form, you'll notice on the front side in the upper left-hand corner, it says chart/MPO. At the bottom of that first column are some questions where we ask you to tell us about yourself. And so what we're asking about is the zip code where you live, how far you drive to work or school or another sort of daily destination. And we know that that's going to vary for everybody. How long it takes you to get to work or school or that other daily destination in minutes, and how you usually get around town. Do you carpool? Do you drive alone? Do you walk, bike, bus? Or perhaps you telecommute from home, or perhaps you have some other mode. I worked for a while in Dubuque, Iowa, and there were a surprising number of people that paddled canoes on the Mississippi River. So yes, if you could just take a moment and fill those in, and then we'll move on to the sort of the input part of the session. Okay, why don't we move on? At the lower right-hand corner of the first page, this is my favorite part of this form, it says, wait, there's more. I love that. So turn over to the back, and on the back, we really start to get into funding issues. This is one of the most complicated parts of the transportation system, and our issues is funding. You can imagine all of these transportation system improvements are very costly, and in the state of Virginia and in the country, we're really in the middle of a transportation funding crisis. And so we wanted to give you some information about how we fund our transportation system. As you know, the state of Virginia is facing a significant budget shortfall. The last fiscal year, we received about $3.1 billion for all purposes for transportation. And the pie chart there shows where those funds came from. 52% of all transportation revenue in Virginia came from either federal or state fuel taxes and other taxes that contribute to our transportation revenue. But historically, those revenues are failing to keep up with economic growth, population, and inflation. So you can see at the top, federal motor fuels tax is 26%. State motor fuels tax is also about 26%. There's an auto insurance premium tax of about 5%. Motor vehicle sales tax of about 13%. 16% of our transportation funds come from retail sales taxes, 8% from license fees, and 6% from others. What's going on in this country is that our transportation vehicles, our cars, are increasing in efficiency. And as they increase in efficiency, they use less gas, and so as a result, they pay less tax. In Virginia, our state fuels tax has been 17.5 cents per gallon since 1987. We actually have the 11th lowest fuel taxes in the United States. The average state fuel tax is 29 cents a gallon. In Virginia here, Virginia maintains 125,000 lane miles of road, and there are 475 new lane miles of road built every year. Virginia's road system is the third largest state-maintained system in the country, and that's because Virginia, as opposed to every other state in the country, maintains the entire road system outside of the independent cities like Charlottesville. Every other state in the country, the counties maintain the roads outside the cities that are more or less county roads, and then the state maintains the state highways. Our fuel tax, as we noted, has been at 17.5% since 1987. In 1987, obviously, the purchase power of the fuel tax was 17.5 cents. What has happened, of course, since 1987 is we've had inflation. And so today, the actual purchasing power of that 17.5 cents in 1987 dollars is down to 8.4 cents. And so it's basically been cut in half by inflation over the course of the last 20 years. The purple line, the yellow line shows our fuel tax. The purple line shows the purchasing power of our fuel tax, and you can see the way that's dropped over the course of years. The green line shows what the fuel tax would need to be at to maintain the same purchasing power that it had in 1987. And so today, our fuel tax would need to increase to 36.2 cents per gallon to have the same purchasing power that it had at 17.5 cents in 1987. This is the way the Commonwealth allocates its transportation funds. About 43.5% of transportation funds go to highway maintenance and operations. The next biggest share is about 17.7% goes to highway system construction. Another 10.5% goes to tolls, administration, and other programs. Earmarks and special allocations take up just a little bit under 10%. Public transportation and rail take up about 9%. Debt service only takes up just under 7%. That's actually low. Many states in the country have a much higher rate of debt service. I'm told that about half of the state of New York's transportation funds go to debt service. And then finally, about 1.4% goes to ports and aviation, and about 1% goes to other agencies and other types of transfers. This is a comparison of the state fuels tax, you know, for Virginia and the surrounding states. You can see that Virginia's tax is 17.5 cents per gallon. North Carolina is over 30 cents. Washington, D.C. is at 23.5. West Virginia is at 32.2 cents per gallon. Maryland's at 23.5. Tennessee's at 21.4. And Kentucky's at 22.5. So the average for all the states in this immediate area is 28.9 cents. And you'll notice the last column over there that says indexed. Some states are indexing their gas taxes now, which means that they automatically go up or down to track inflation. And so the idea is to prevent them, you know, their purchasing power from changing because of inflation. Here are the federal and state fuel tax comparisons nationwide. I'm not going to read all of those on the map to you. Sarah, do you remember which state has the lowest? I think New Jersey has the high. No, it's not New Jersey. Oh, it's Connecticut. Connecticut and California are the highest. California is at 65 cents. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right, Alaska. Yeah, they pump it straight out of the ground and into your tank in Alaska. 65 cents a gallon of fuel tax in California, 62.8% in Hawaii, 60 cents up in Connecticut. And then I think next one down is Illinois, which is 57 cents per gallon. The way spending has been going, or basically federal and state spending for transportation improvements, this is City of Charlottesville. These are dollars and millions. And so in 2006, which is the first bar, there was about $2.5 million in state and federal funds spent here. It was a little below $2 million in 07. In 08, that was up to $3.5 million. There was some spending related to Meadow Creek Parkway. In 09, it was a little bit above $2.5 million. Here in fiscal year 10, it's down at about $600,000. And in 11, it is going to be at about $1.5 million. Albemarle County, it was about, in 06, it was about $3.5 million. 7 was about $3.7 million. 8 was up over $4 million. 9 was back at $3.5 million. 10, it's down to $1.5 million. And 11, it's down to about $300,000. Yes, ma'am. What accounts for the variation from year to year? There are two things. One is that in both Charlottesville and Albemarle, there have been some significant projects which account for some of the spikes. But the recent budget difficulties at the state level, particularly related to transportation, have been the reason that the numbers have kind of cratered in the last couple of years.
Where is stimulus money?
There wasn't actually all that much stimulus money allocated to projects here in the region. If you will remember, the requirement was that we have projects that were shovel ready, that needed to be ready to go, and there just weren't that many projects in this region that were shovel ready. Now, where we did get some stimulus money in this region was the transit systems did very well. They got a number of new buses, which are pretty expensive items, and so they both transit systems, CAT and Jaunt, were able to mostly replace their fleets with stimulus money. Let's see. What we want to talk about now are some of the projects that were either committed to moving forward in our long-range transportation plan or that we've had under study, but we have not committed to moving forward with them. And the reason I'm bringing this to your attention is that on the back side of your form, I'm going to ask you to rate some things again. In the first column on the second side, you'll see this entire list of transportation projects that are on this slide and the next one. And we would like you to rate each of these projects from not important to very important. Same scale we used before, 1 to 5. And so the first one is improvements at intersections and interchanges on Route 29 North. And so that would include adding grade-separated interchange at Ryo Road and improvements to the Route 250 interchange. That has an expected cost of about $54 million. The next project is the Berkmar Drive Extended, where we're proposing to construct a parallel roadway on the west side of the Route 29 corridor from Hilton Heights Drive, which is where the Walmart is, past the Doubletree, across the river, and all the way north up to Airport Road. And that has an expected cost of $45 million. We're also proposing to improve the major interchanges on Interstate 64, including the interchange at 5th Street, Shadwell, and Route 29. So that's $37.3 million. We're proposing to improve Route 250 East in the Pantops area at a cost of $43 million. We're proposing to establish a regional transit authority to expand transit service out into Albemarle County, and that would have an initial capital cost of $42 million and an annual operating cost of $16.7 million. We're proposing to implement bus rapid transit, which would put transit service that would be sort of like express service, probably run in its own right-of-way with a limited number of stops, probably out here in the 29 corridor somewhere, at a cost of $10 million, and that's really just kind of a down payment cost, if you will. Proposing to improve bike and pedestrian facilities in the region, particularly along 29 North, for another $10 million. Implement transportation demand measures like improve our park and ride lots and enhance intelligent transportation systems for $2 million. Build a connector between Sunset and Sunset Avenue and Fontaine Avenue for $29 million. Complete Hillsdale Drive Extended, which the city just started this year and is mostly complete out there, for $25 million. And also improve and replace the Belmont Bridge here in Charlottesville for $9 million. So those are projects that we have committed funding to in the next 25 years. We then have several, yes, ma'am.
Where is Sunset?
Where is Sunset? Sunset and Fontaine are two roads that are kind of on the south side of Charlottesville and the University of Virginia and immediately east of Route 29, almost in kind of the corner where Route 29 and Interstate 64 come together. Some alternative projects that have been considered and studied but are not proposed for funding at this point are what we call an eastern connector that would connect Route 29 north up around the airport area around to 250 east in the Pantops area, a western bypass that would connect the 250 bypass all the way around to Route 29 north in the Hollymead area, which would cost $232 million. What we call a southern connector, which would construct a roadway that connects Avon Street and Fifth Street extended at a cost of $3.3 million. Improvement or creation of an interchange at right near here at Hydraulic Road and Route 29, and the development of a parallel road to Route 29 North, extending from Ryle Road to the South Fork of the Ravanna River called Northern Free State Road at a cost of $31.3 million. So there's the project list. So we'd like you to kind of tell us which of those you think is most important or least important.
My question is, years ago when I traveled a lot, we would leave Lynchburg and then we'd have to come through 29 South and all. Would the Western Connector connect with a highway that people could travel from Southern Virginia all the way up to Northern Virginia without having to travel on 29?
Well, it would leave the bypass, if you think of it south to north, it would leave the bypass where the Leonard Sandridge Interchange is now near University of Virginia, and then it would kind of go up the west side of the region and ultimately connect back into Route 29 up in the Hollymead area. So that's about as far north as it would go. Yeah. All right. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Funding options.
Yes. Do you have any true bypasses? That quote 29 bypass comes right into the city, the university. Do you have any true bypasses?
Well, that's the bypass proposal that's been studied over the course of the past 20 years, and there aren't any proposals to do, you know, further bypasses that...
Yeah.
That bypass
has been rated by I forget who as some of the worst ideas that have been taking place. I don't remember who it was that rated that. Maybe somebody else would, but they say it's, you know, it comes into the city and it doesn't bypass at all.
Well, I've heard the same thing, and our MPO policy board doesn't think it's a very good idea, and that's why they haven't prioritized it. The next question we'd like you to respond to is: would you support an increase in tax revenue to make certain transportation improvements? So that's just yes or no. And then sort of the related second question is, if you would not support an increase in tax revenue, how would you fund improvements for our transportation system? And there's actually a section in the middle of the second page for you to write down what your ideas would be about funding our transportation system in the future. And then the last thing that we'd like to ask you about is what kind of options would you like us to consider in order to support transportation or infrastructure? And we've got some ideas here for you to think about, and again, we ask you to rank those on your form 1 to 5. A local sales tax, this is what's happened in many other parts of the country. Increased motor fuels tax, a motor vehicle registration fee, property tax, a vehicle miles traveled fee, and so the way that would work would be that on an annual basis or some basis like that, you would be taxed on the number of miles that you drove your car. You drove your car 1,000 miles, your tax wouldn't be very big. You drove your car 40,000 miles, it would be a lot bigger. A special taxing district, which would be like the property tax, except it would be for a limited area where a transportation improvement was proposed. What they call congestion pricing, which is charging a fee on drivers using a roadway during the peak hours. And so one area of the country that's doing this, for instance, is Seattle. There's a highway out there that is a toll road, and if you drive it in the middle of the night when nobody else is on the road, your toll is a quarter. If you drive it in the middle of the afternoon rush hour and you want to use the Diamond Lane, you'll pay $8.50 as a toll. And so the idea is to let people choose how much they want to pay to avoid congestion, or perhaps you have some other ideas. And so we'd like to ask you to rate those ideas or write in, you know, what your other ideas might be. So that really completes our input. And if you have any other suggestions to make to us, I think every other session I've done like this, People have had lots of ideas. There's a space right down here at the bottom of the second page for you to put in other ideas. What we're going to do is that we're going to take these forms back. As I said, we're collecting, hoping to collect these forms from 400 or 500 people over the next couple of years. We're going to summarize and analyze the input we get, and then we'll be providing that to our MPO policy board on a regular basis. So with that, I think I want to thank you for participating, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have at this point. So somebody want to bring the lights up and then hand out the microphone? And sir?
Just looking over the things you'd said before, especially on the diesel tax, seems like that's an automatic pickup right there, that you could increase that and still not be out of line with border states like West Virginia and others that might pick up the traffic from incoming transportation.
Sure.
So that looks like a good point to begin. And then when you get to the tax end of it, the user seems to be the person who should suffer the most from any increases, and I think that using a fuel tax would be more logical than having a mileage situation per year, which can be fudged anyway. I don't know how in the world you'd work that out without doing it on state inspections to see how much mileage you had last year and how much you had this year. So the third thing is that right now the United States is in a very bad situation financially, and we haven't gotten out of it yet. But there are a lot of people with cash in this country, and the interest yields on cash are extremely, what would you say?
Low.
They're looking for places where they can make money on their cash.
Sure.
It looks to me they're going to have to pay, they're going to get less in interest on their cash now than they will when the times get better again. And also it would serve, if we use bond issues, private bond issues, I believe that would be probably the best method by which to start something now that would also help the infrastructure. It'd give you all money, it would give us transportation, and it seems to me a very logical thing to do. I'd like to know what your reaction to that is.
Well,
or
sir,
proactive reaction.
Well, and I guess, you know, particularly with regard to the last issue of creating investment opportunities, that is something that Virginia has actually been taking the lead in nationwide. We call it public-private partnerships, and the idea is to create portions of our transportation system that are built with private financing and then are tolled, typically, in some fashion, so that to pay off the private investment. And you're right. Those have been a very attractive investment for those that have the money to put into them. And so that's an area that both the state and the federal government are exploring very aggressively.
I had made a mistake when I said 29 North. What I was referring to was if I were coming from the South and got to Lynchburg, and would, so that would be, instead of going through Colesville, Bates, you know,
right,
if a connector road could take you all the way up to Northern Virginia. So a lot of people could avoid 29.
Yeah. Well, and the only proposal I've heard that would accomplish that is a proposal that was floated in the last planning process for Route 29 that focused on a completely new highway that would start on the east side of Albemarle County and basically follow the railroad tracks up through Gordonsville, Orange, to Culpeper, and join 29 back up north of Culpeper. Okay. That's the one proposal I've heard like that. That really didn't get much further in the process beyond just a suggestion, and it was not well received, and so it kind of died at that point. Over here, yes?
I have a general question and a specific question. The specific question first, it's been a year with the regional Northeast Amtrak train, mm-hmm. and there was an article about it in the Daily Progress on Friday. And for the life of me, from the numbers that they give in the article, I cannot understand the answer to the simple bottom line question. With the usage that it had in the first year, is it paying for itself or not? That's my specific question.
It's probably close to paying for itself you have to understand there was quite a capital investment that was required to start that because there were some additional trains that had to be purchased, some trackage that had to be upgraded.
Right.
And so if you include just the operating cost, it's certainly paying for itself, but it's not covering the capital cost that had to go in at the front end.
But if you amortize it over some number of years, is there hope that it really will stand on its own bottom?
It'll probably come close over the course of years. Actually, the problem we have has not been ridership. The problem is that there's so much train traffic on that line, particularly in the Northern Virginia area, that we can't put enough trains to serve our market on the line. That's actually proving to be the biggest issue.
Now, since I have the microphone, I'm going to ask my general question before President Hodgson steals it from me. For this region, if you talk about mass transportation and so forth, now, looking ahead over the next couple of decades, there's certainly no reason to think that gas prices will go down on average, right? So can you forecast a time, and in this region where the population density is fairly sparse, at least in much of the county, do you have some sort of a vision where you could actually put some mass transportation in place that would, again, be pretty much self-sufficient, pay for itself?
What we think has to happen for that to occur is for gas prices to go to $4, $5, $6 a gallon and stay there. When we had the spike, when was that? Summer of 2008, I think. When we had the spike in summer of 2008, I was working in New Hampshire, but what we saw up there was that there was about a 20% shift, people away from cars into transit. Transit ridership spiked by about 20%. And we were actually interested in that because there were some people that thought it would spike even more than that. And what we eventually figured out was that given where people live and where they work, there were only about 20% of people who could really use the transit system to get around the way they needed. And they couldn't afford to move just because of a temporary spike in gas prices. So we saw that 20% spike. But what we think would happen if the price went to $4, $5, $6 a gallon and stayed there is people would start making different choices about where they live and work and where they shop and other things like that. And they would start locating in places because they're well served by transit. And that's what we think has to happen before transit really, really takes off. Yes, sir, Mr. Faltz.
Yes. On your chart there, we had the Western Bypass, which is sort of with a $250 million price tag, which has been kind of a stalking horse. I mean, it's a proposed four-lane highway with at least three overpasses, and I think everybody thinks it's a dead issue. But we've been talking about parallel roads, and VDOT owns a huge amount of property running right down to Leonard Sandridge Road, and we need another entrance into the university. How do we feel about that property and putting in a two-lane parkway, a commuter road to get people to the university?
Well, when you say we, do you mean me, John, or do you want to show a hands of the people in the room? What are you looking for here?
let me be specific. There have been people who wanted to give that land back to the original owners, get rid of the VDOT ownership. How does the Thomas Jefferson Planning District feel about that particular thing? Should we keep that land for a potential parallel road?
Well, the policy board hasn't changed its position on that particular question here recently, John. I think the position of the MPO policy board is that we can meet our long-range transportation needs for travel on 29 within the existing corridor by doing things like improving the interchanges, doing grade separations at the major roadways, and providing other things like parallel connecting roads or frontage roads. So the position is that we can meet at least 25 years worth of need in that manner. In terms of what becomes of the right-of-way, that's really a state question, because it's their right-of-way. It's up to them to sell it or do whatever else they want with it. I would suspect that if it ever came down to a point where the state of Virginia was actually contemplating selling it, the MPO might actually be able to think of other transportation uses that would preserve that right-of-way, you know, in case there is a need for it in the very long future. But frankly, the question has never been asked. Who would you like? Yes, ma'am, in the back.
I recently was astounded by the Warrington mess. And I have no idea where all that stuff came from up there. In the last 8 miles to the intersection with 64, there are at least 10 traffic lights, most of them actually in the last 5 miles. So I now travel around Manassas. Now my question is, did it take 20 years to plan that and put it in, and then you end up with that? So, you know, what do we gain from any of this, really?
Well, you know, I guess the way I would address that is I would point you back to the 29 corridor here. Is you almost have to understand the fact that our transportation system is built, maintained, and operated by a state agency. Our land use decisions are made by our local governments, and it is often difficult to coordinate those. And that's, you know, I think certainly true wherever you go, and we've learned some very hard lessons about that in this region. And then I think the other issue is, and this is one that people don't tend to recognize, is that often there's a land use approval for a subdivision, a shopping center, something like that, and then it doesn't get built for years, 10 years, something like that. And so it looks like it just suddenly got approved and sprang out of the ground, when in reality it was approved 10 years before, and the folks at that point were not as cognizant of those issues as we are perhaps today. Just here last week, I was driving on 29 up in Greene County, and I noticed that they have started grading for a large subdivision in southern Greene County that was approved years and years ago and includes a new access point onto 29, but has just basically been sitting there for a long time. Well, apparently the market has turned, and now the owner thinks he's gonna make his money by building that thing out. And so that's the other thing that we see happening, is the length of time that often occurs between approval and when the market actually, you know, brings something into development. Yes, ma'am.
Well, three things. The first thing is that Western Connector is what I believe we've always needed, and that was why the state bought those houses. And that's what Lynchburg has begged for, but it's never going to happen because of the development and also the ownership of the lands that would go through. So that's the first thing. Second, I noticed that Virginia is so low compared to anybody else in the taxes, because we want the services, but we will not pay taxes for it. So how are we ever going to get it? And third, the Meadowbrook Parkway. I don't understand how Albemarle is almost finished with its part, and Charlottesville can change its mind after an agreement was made to complete this, and because people start protesting after the agreement was already made, it's halted. So how can that happen?
Well, speaking to Meadow Creek Parkway, I don't think the city has changed its mind. The project continues to move forward. If you noticed in the paper, not sure if it was last week or the week before, it said that Federal Highway Administration had approved the design and the permits for the roadway. What is expected, I think, is that there will be another lawsuit that will have to be adjudicated before the project can actually move forward. But the city is committed to the project, and they have the funds, their share of the funds, committed in their capital improvement project program to move the project forward. So they're still anticipating that both their share of the roadway and the interchange are going to happen. It's just more of the, you know, things that delay these transportation projects, lawsuits, permitting, things like that. Yes. Sir.
It seems to me that parking is one of those issues that greatly restricts the usage of roads. I'm thinking now particularly of downtown Charlottesville. If there was more parking, there'd be a lot more people down there until you couldn't get through the corner, which is almost the case now. But it seems very odd to me that we leave that to separate entities, private business for the most part, a little bit of municipal. But is there any movement at all to integrate the coordination of land use, parking, and the roads? Because they don't seem to be in balance.
Well, there's no movement that I know of to integrate those. And as you say, that is an interesting issue. The other thing you might want to keep in mind is that the major thing that drives people to ride transit in a downtown area is not congestion, it's parking cost. And that's, I mean, we actually have one of the most successful transit systems in the country right here in Charlottesville. But if there was a higher parking cost than we have downtown today, there would be even more people riding our transit system than we currently do. So parking is a pretty delicate issue. You can imagine there are lots of downtown business owners who want parking to be free and widely available. So it is a very difficult political issue. Someone else.
I was just going to comment on the lady's comment about Meadow Creek Parkway. And I remember back in 1964, I think it was, I talked to Bob Tucker, who at that time was an engineer, and suggested to him.
And a young guy at that point, right?
I suggested to him that might be a good idea to put something in. I was thinking about the Greenbrier Park area. He said, well, we've already got an idea, and that Greenbrier Park has sort of real problems with it because of the water in that land. And that was in 1964. This is 46 years later. Francis, I see you back there. And he's the former mayor of Charlottesville and been around. He really knows what goes on politically. What is it? Huh? What did he say?
One of many.
I think maybe Tom is saying that there's time for one more question.
One more question.
Yes, sir.
In your experience around the country, have you seen, is the political problem we have here getting the city and the county to cooperate a little bit? Is this typical of other areas where you've been since you've worked the MPO process?
No, people fight everywhere. It's actually, I find the people in Virginia to be a lot more cooperative. I came from New England, and I decided that the only two things that people are good at in New England are snow removal and fighting. Well, thank you very much. You've been a great audience, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.